All right, hello everyone. Thank you so much for joining us again for our second session. This time we're going to be talking about climate change and water resources. This session is going to be a little bit different than last session in that I'm only going to be using the PowerPoint for a little bit in the start of the session. And then after that, we'll have a little bit more of a discussion back and forth, and you're going to have a chance to draw out some ideas if you wish. It's not tested, you don't have to hand anything in, so you don't have to. But Julia and Brian are passing out some clipboards and paper and crayons. And you can maybe take a couple of colors of crayon if you like. Okay, so we'll just jump in and get started. First thing, what do you think? Is climate change a new-ish idea? I just want to take a poll of the room. When do you think the idea of human-caused climate change was first understood? Anyone? You can just shout out a year that you think is plausible.
1970,
okay, what else?
1890,
okay, what else? Any other ideas?
That's a big
1979.
1920. Okay, great. Awesome. Well, wow, you guys are actually more on the ball on this than when I ask other groups. In fact, one of the earliest sort of mentions of this idea of human-caused climate change was from quite a famous chemist, Svante Arrhenius, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name quite right. He was a chemist, and he has some famous equations named after him, but he also dabbled in earth science. There's a picture of him in 1909, but he actually came out in 1896 with this idea that the earth's temperature was linked to carbon dioxide and water vapor in the atmosphere. And so he actually predicted that with a doubling of carbon dioxide, it would increase temperature by 5 degrees Celsius. So it's really quite an amazing calculation prediction, but from somebody over 100 years ago. So this idea is not new. The theory is very well understood, but it's true that, you know, in the 70s and 80s, that's when in the United States, scientists really started to talk about this issue, and there were many scientists talking about it at that point, but it wasn't really penetrating the public's consciousness as much. So there's some theoretical underpinnings from quite a long time ago. But let's just think about, you know, how is the Earth's temperature regulated? So this is a figure from the IPCC, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a UN organization looking at climate change issues. And here we're looking, these numbers and arrows are representing radiation fluxes. And radiation is just basically energy, energy that is then used to heat. The real driver of the warming of Earth is, of course, the sun, right? We all learned that in elementary school. The sun is what gives us our warmth. And so this is the incoming solar radiation comes in, some of that solar radiation bounces off clouds and other things in the atmosphere, goes back out, doesn't even have a chance to hit the Earth's surface. Some of it hits the Earth's surface, but then is reflected. And then a lot of it is absorbed by the surface. So when it's absorbed, that's when it heats up the Earth. And then there are these other exchanges of energy as well. So just like thermal currents and evapotranspiration is also a way of transferring energy. So it's called latent heat. But then there is also this long-wave radiation. So short-wave radiation is also known as solar, is radiation coming from the sun. So this is radiation that's coming from an incredibly hot body that is the sun, and its radiation has very short wavelengths. Cooler bodies emit radiation as well, but it's much longer wavelengths. So that's why we kind of distinguish between those two. So long wave radiation is coming back from the Earth's surface, much cooler surface, and it's bouncing back off the surface, or being emitted by the surface rather, and then some of that's getting kind of get through and leaves the Earth's atmosphere. But actually, look at how much, a lot of it gets caught by greenhouse gases and is radiated back. And so this is, you know, these are greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that radiate that heat back to Earth and keep us at the temperature that we're used to. And so this is known as the greenhouse effect.
What does WM3 stand for?
Watts per meter squared. So watts is an energy term, and per, you know, meter squared of Earth's surface. Yeah, thanks for that question. So there's all of this accounting here basically is, if we're in a stable, if we're in an unchanging climate and our Earth is stable, we would expect all of the, you know, the radiation coming in to be balanced by the radiation going out. But if we have an unequal situation here, then that's where we experience global change. So we can see, you know, if we have less leaving, then it would be cooling. And if we have, if we have more coming in than it's leaving, then we're warming. And if we have more leaving than coming in, we're cooling. This greenhouse effect is really important. It is a natural process. It's something that has occurred, it has existed well before humans, and it's really important. So if we look here at, this is just a graph of temperature on the x-axis here and pressure on the y-axis, and basically what this is showing is, how does water exist under this, these two conditions of varying temperature and varying pressure? If you have really high temperature and sort of normal pressure that we're used to around one atmosphere, then water is not going to be liquid, it's going to be a gas, it'll be water vapor. And then if you get below zero, you know, it turns into ice, right? So one thing that you can kind of note from this graph is actually there's just sort of a small sweet window there where we have liquid water, which is so important to us, our life. And you'll also notice what this graph is showing is, you know, an estimation of how these different planets, Mars, Earth, and Venus, would change, how their average global temperature would change if it had no greenhouse effect. So, you know, Venus has a really strong greenhouse effect. And so if it didn't have it, it would actually move into having liquid water on that planet. But for us on Earth, if we didn't have our greenhouse effect, our average Earth temperature would actually decrease by about 20 to 30 degrees Celsius. So right now, the Earth's average temperature is about 15 degrees Celsius on average. And so we would drop down to about, you know, negative 15 or 16 degrees Celsius. So it'd be really icy cold, and we probably wouldn't have evolved, right? We'd have other dominant species on Earth. So that's a kind of important idea to consider. And then Mars has, you know, not very much greenhouse effect, so it really doesn't change very much. These other ones here, really very little would happen without those gases in the atmosphere. This is just back to that idea of, you know, for about the last 10,000 years, we've been in a pretty stable climate, so this has been in balance, but now we're getting to this point where humans have increased these greenhouse gases. And so now we are seeing, and we expect to see, this back radiation increasing. You know, at some point, if we stop emitting greenhouse gases, we'll get to a new equilibrium, but it'll be at a higher temperature, right? And if we continue to emit those greenhouse gases, then we're going to stay in disequilibrium, and the temperatures will just keep on increasing in that way. So let's think then about what are some of the major anthropogenic greenhouse gases. So anthropogenic meaning they come from humans. There are greenhouse gases that really aren't generated by us. So water vapor is a very strong greenhouse gas, but that's just we might be impacting that a little bit, but we're not really heavily impacting that greenhouse gas. So we're just going to look at the major ones that we're impacting and changing right now. So the biggest one that I'm sure probably all of you have heard about is carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is the major contributing gas to climate change. It accounts for about 50 to 60% of the warming that we are seeing now and that we expect to see in the near term. So the average time that it spends in the atmosphere, it varies widely. So maybe about 100 years, but then it can't, some molecules of carbon dioxide can be even longer than that. And so because this is sort of the stand, this is the main greenhouse gas, this is sort of what we think about first when we think of how we're affecting the climate. We kind of think about all other greenhouse gases as they compare to carbon dioxide. So there's this idea of global warming potential. It's a really important idea that lets us understand, you know, how much would one molecule of this gas, how much does it warm the Earth compared to carbon dioxide? So because we're comparing us to carbon dioxide's global warming potential is one, right? And then the major human sources of carbon dioxide are burning fossil fuels, deforestation, and cement production. So these are the really big ways that we are emitting this into the environment. Yes?
Can you explain a little bit about cement and how that's a factor?
Yeah. You know, I'm not entirely sure about the chemistry of that, but can you explain that a little bit more, Brian?
I know there's a tremendous amount of energy expended in the cement making process. So I think it's through the process of manufacturing it that it releases an incredible amount of carbon dioxide.
Doesn't it come from the mining too? We have to mine the gravel,
and you mine the cement.
Mm-hmm. And just the opening them up to the earth emits carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm.
The trucking is the whole process of actually manufacturing it that releases a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide. So they're kind of looking at the full life cycle of it and tallying it all up here, and that's how it ends up being one of these top ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've seen that it's usually quoted, I think, around 10% of the source.
Wow.
So yeah, it is significant, even though it's easily forgotten. Yeah.
Where does agriculture fit into those categories?
Oh yeah, that's a great great question. So it would fit a lot here, deforestation, because oftentimes agriculture is taking the place where previously had been forests. Agriculture is often also touted as a potential solution that farmers can, you know, by good soil husbandry, keep more carbon in the soil, and so that the agriculture could also turn out to be a bit of a sink of carbon, depending on how it's done. But the real big problem with agriculture is that you often have to deforest a land to put agriculture on there.
You've all heard about the methane associated with cows.
That's
also a big issue as well. It's surprising because I think methane is 30 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, something like that.
That's coming
many,
up.
Many times.
I've got that on the next slide. So agriculture definitely fits in with some of the other greenhouse gases too. Yeah, that's a really good point. But for carbon dioxide in particular, the way agriculture is impacting this greenhouse gas is mostly deforestation. And then I do want to point out here, so this is Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, and so there has been a long record of observing carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere at that site. So this was a very, this scientist, Dr. Keeling, this was in the 1960s, recognized that it would be important to monitor carbon dioxide and that, that this was changing. And so he started this record, so it's our longest and most famous, but there are many other observatories around the Earth observing this as well. And so what you can see here is the red line here is the monthly measurement of carbon dioxide, and we can see it is increasing. But there is also a seasonal pattern, a very strong seasonal pattern there. Anybody have any idea why there might be a seasonal pattern to the carbon dioxide that is observed at this observatory?
Air movements?
Yeah, certainly air movements and mixing. And so this is an, this site was picked because it was high enough that it seemed to be like a good representation of the general region. So it's not like just localized air movements there. But there's something else, there's something bigger that's sort of making this very consistent pattern showing up.
Summer in North America.
Yeah, summer in North America, yeah. Good. So it's summer in the Northern Hemisphere, in fact. So because there's larger land mass in the Northern Hemisphere than the Southern Hemisphere, the photosynthetic signal that we can see in our atmosphere is we're really picking up the Northern Hemisphere, peak photosynthesis times, which would be in the spring and summer, when carbon dioxide is being taken out of the atmosphere. And so those are the times that we would have a lower dip in this record. And then in the winter, in the Northern Hemisphere, plants, they photosynthesize, so they take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and turn it into oxygen. They also respire, like animals do as well. That means they burn carbon and create carbon dioxide to get energy. And so there's going to be more respiration than photosynthesis in the winter, and so we see that seasonal pattern. And so it's nice, it's a good thing to notice because, carbon dioxide, it's in the atmosphere even without us, right? And so I think that's oftentimes a little bit of a confusing point for people. It's carbon dioxide, how could it be a pollutant? We produce it just when we breathe, right? It's just a natural part of the cycle. That's true, but these concentrations are produced by our human behavior.
And they do, NOAA has some kind of profoundly beautiful animations. The internet's not so hot here, but essentially they've got long-term satellite images, and so they can animate it and kind of speed it up, and so you're looking at Earth from a satellite view, and you're watching the seasons go by. It's a color image, and you're watching the seasons, as you mentioned, essentially summertime in the Northern Hemisphere, all the leaves come out, and you see it green up, and then get kind of icy and cold again, and snowy and such. So you're seeing the Earth go through these patterns, and alongside of it, they have animated graphs, moving graphs, where you can actually watch the seasonal effect on the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. So it's really like you're just watching the Earth breathe, and it's kind of meditative. Honestly, I said the first time I saw it, I think 10 or 15 minutes went by. Just hit replay and watch it again. It's really, you should try to Google it. It's quite neat.
Yeah, they really, NOAA is doing some really amazing sort of communication work about this issue, so definitely check that out. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, don't Google it here, though.
Okay, so then the next sort of class of gases is the high global warming potential gases. I've sort of grouped them together here. These are CFCs, HFCs, so chlorofluorocarbons, hydrofluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride are some of the main ones. And so these are really trace gases in the atmosphere. They're very, very, very low concentrations, but their contribution to climate change is really quite huge compared to their actual concentration in the atmosphere. So 15 to 25% is a bit of a wide range there. And that's partially due, they have really long lifespans that they will persist in the environment, in the atmosphere. So depending on which specific gas, so this is a lot of classic gases, these are class of gases, the 100 to 3,000 years. And the global warming potential is 10,000 to 20,000. So 10,000 to 20,000 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So these ones are really important to keep a close watch on. One thing I just want to sort of point out here, when I'm talking about global warming potential, I'm talking about the global warming potential over the next 100 years. Sometimes people calculate this at a different time scale, like over 20 years, but the standard way is thinking about it over 100. And because of the different lifetimes of these different gases, you'll get different values for the global warming potentials over the lifespan. But we're thinking about them on the 100-year life.
Excuse me.
Lifespan.
I can't see what the ordinance on that graph is.
Oh, yes. Here, this is, so this is year. Sorry, this is a very small graph, also taken from NOAA. So this starts in, 1997 and goes out to 2020. And it's starting at, this is sulfur hexafluoride mole fraction part per trillion. So very, very tiny measure. Usually we talk about contaminants in parts per million or parts per billion. This is parts per trillion.
Where does that come from? Hexafluoride.
Yeah, great question. So this is, it's used in energy transmission. And I don't really know any more details than that. But it's kind of a small, something that has been used there. And then the other thing to note is there's no seasonal trend here. These are not natural gases and are not present naturally in our environment, so they have only been introduced by humans. So the main sources, especially for CFCs and HFCs, are refrigerants, electricity transmission for the sulfur hexafluoride, and there are newer refrigerants that can replace these. So there is a lot of work going on to try to stop the use of these in particular, and also in old refrigerators or old air conditioning units, it's really important to recycle them and try to get those chemicals out of them, because it's really in the disposal process of those units that these gases are released. So this is kind of like a hidden way of reducing our carbon footprint, is by being really, really careful with our with how we're dealing with refrigerants and coolants.
Yeah, and most people associate CFCs with the ozone layer, mm-hmm. right? Historically, if you think about it, that became very famous for that reason. But actually, they also really, really bad for global climate change as well.
Yeah.
Are there regulations about recycling these gases because of their potential?
Yes, there are. I don't know I think there are also federal regulations of them, and I think that local municipalities will also have their own, but I don't know too much of the details of that. But there was a recent international agreement similar to the Montreal Protocol for the CFCs and the ozone layer that now has come to deal with these refrigerants and to phase them out and to only use. So in terms of the new models that are being produced, they're phasing those out, but in terms of recycling and disposing of those products, I believe there are, but I don't know too many details about what they are.
It's very state, region, country specific. A lot of places are just, it's a free for all. And so, refrigerants are actually projected to be one of the, if not the most important ways that we can try to reduce our carbon impact. Because we have improved the technology. CFCs were the worst, and we've been improving, but the improvements are only slightly better. So we got a long ways to go, I think, to really address this particular issue.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, actually. CFCs were the worst for ozone hole, right? And we very effectively, as an international community, sort of stopped that and switched over to HFCs. But actually, HFCs have a higher global warming potential and some of the other replacements. So, because they weren't thinking about that at the time of the Montreal Protocol agreement.
Just as a reference,
right? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, what year was it that we really started becoming aware of the CFCs? And I seem to remember, a time when they were really starting talking about the ozone.
Yeah, 80s. Yeah. And when that kind of came to the forefront, we were just really tracking this hole in the ozone.
Yeah.
Around then is when we had the technology to actually detect the hole in the ozone. And so that was around then that, it became, the public became aware of this issue. But now it's evolved to be, well, now we get global climate change. And the hotter it gets, the more air conditioners people want. Yeah. And a lot of developing countries, very rightly so, they want to have air conditioning too. And now their quality and standard of living has increased, mm-hmm. which is great for them. And of course, now they can afford a refrigerator, and now they can afford an air conditioner. Now they're all getting them. And so it's just really a global issue, but as Joe pointed out, we have successfully addressed the CFC ozone issue. And so we're hoping that we as a world can do the same thing for the HFCs, et cetera. So we'll see, but there's precedence for feeling hopeful.
The refrigerators, what year did they make a change from the old to the...
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I think if you're getting anything you're buying now new, it wouldn't have the HFCs in it. It would have the newer technology. But
I think it was the early 2000s, but I'd have to look that up. I'm not really sure. I think it was around the early 2000s.
Excuse me. So they've addressed the issue of the refrigerants, and these developing countries are getting their air conditioners and refrigeration, which now in turn, the unintended consequences is more electricity transmission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're boosting the SF portion of the equation.
Also,
You're addressing the refrigerants, and in the meantime, you need more electricity.
It's a wicked problem, really. It's one of these problems that's just, it's from all angles, we need to be thinking and working on this.
I need grandma's icebox is what I need.
right.
Is that the amount of sulfur hexafluoride related to how the electricity is generated, do you think? Did solar generation help?
I'm sorry, I really have very limited knowledge of these, only just that they are major contributors, but I'm not too knowledgeable about how they're used in these processes. And this one especially, I could do some more research on that, because that's an interesting one, in terms of what are the ways that they're replacing that, or are they? Good questions.
It's too bad it doesn't have a more pronounceable name.
Yeah.
It's harder to generate awareness if you can't pronounce the word.
You mean the hexafluoride?
Those are the high global warming potential gases. Then next on the list, in terms of their global warming potential or contribution to global warming, is methane. So its contribution to climate change is somewhere between 12% and 20%. Its actual concentration in our atmosphere is of the greenhouse gases is second only to carbon dioxide. So we have more of it in there, but it's got less of a global warming potential. So its lifetime in the atmosphere is pretty modest. It's only about 12 years. And its global warming potential over a 100-year period is 25. So it's about 25 times what carbon dioxide is. Of course, if we looked at it over a shorter time period, this number would be quite a bit higher. I think it's in the 70s if we're looking at it over 20 years. So the sources of this, human sources, fossil fuel, agriculture, and landfills are the biggest sources in North America. This is another of those. So in particular, in agriculture, it is cows and sheep. In the flatulence of them, it's produced in environments where you don't have oxygen. So there are these bacteria that can then break down carbon in an anaerobic environment, and when they do that, they produce methane instead of carbon dioxide. In particular, if we're adding a lot of a high carbon material to our landfills, oxygen doesn't get to get in there, and so it gets, if we put our food waste in landfill, that's a big problem for producing methane. So composting, keeping your food waste out of the garbage, is a great way to reduce that stream of methane. fossil fuel extraction and transport, sometimes methane would be a byproduct of when you're extracting petroleum, and it's not, you don't get a high enough amount of it, it's worth to sell it, it might just leak into the atmosphere directly. So we have to be very careful with that. Mm-hmm. Anything else to note about methane? Any questions about that? Yeah.
I just think it's curious to No, regarding agriculture, that it's not necessarily the flatulence of the cow, it's the inability of the environment to use the methane at the terrestrial level. So like a herd of bison going across a prairie aren't creating methane in the atmosphere, but a dead feedlot with a bunch of cows on it, none of that methane gets consumed and used by bacteria at the terrestrial level, so it escapes to the atmosphere.
Yeah, interesting.
So that cow on that pasture isn't that bad because it's not making a stink, but all the carbon there absorbs all that methane.
I know that, I know that also there's a lot of research being done about, you know, what is the feed that is being fed to cows, because that can also have a big influence on the methane production there. So, and I think you're right that the wild ungulates aren't producing anywhere near like the feedlot domesticated animals.
We can balance in that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
The Australians, with their experiment with the seaweed derivative fed to livestock, does away with the flatulence problem.
Interesting.
Any animal with multiple stomachs puts it out. Uh-huh. It doesn't matter if you feed them grain or grass, they still have flatulence. But with that additive, that's the Australians are experimenting with, according to a PBS program I listened to.
Neat. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
So looking at lifetime in the atmosphere, 12 years, and the global warming potential would be 25 years?
No, so this is basically, this number means like how many times, like one molecule of methane has 20 times the potential to heat the Earth than one molecule of carbon dioxide. So again, that number is just always a way to compare it to carbon dioxide. Yeah, great question, thanks. All right, let's, so then the last greenhouse gas I want to talk about is nitrous oxide. It contributes about 5% of to the warming. Its atmospheric lifetime is 121 years, and its global warming potential is 265. So it's got a very high global warming potential. Human sources of this would be fertilizer applied to agriculture, fossil fuel biomass combustion, and industry. And again, you know, there are natural sources of nitrous oxide, and bacteria are involved in the production of nitrous oxide from this agricultural system. So basically what happens here is when you add nitrogen in agricultural fields, bacteria in the soil break it down, and they don't always break it down as completely as they want to when they're in anaerobic environments, and so they'll release this nitrous oxide. It's sort of just an accidental byproduct, but it happens when we add too much nitrogen to those fields. And so then you can see there's like a little bit of a seasonal trend, but it's not as much for methane and carbon dioxide. Any questions about that? Otherwise, I'll turn off the PowerPoint and we'll start doing some drawings. Yes.
So wasn't biomass at some point an alternative to fossil fuels? So how's it the same?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so biomass, in terms of when we're thinking about carbon dioxide emissions, theoretically, biomass should be a carbon neutral, in terms of carbon dioxide, a carbon neutral source of energy, because biomass means it's like plant matter. So plants take carbon out of the atmosphere when they're in their growing phase, and then when you're burning them, you know, you're releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but that was taken out before. But in the actual burning process, you know, there's also nitrogen present in the biomass, and so there will be some nitrous oxide that's also released. The other thing that we do have to be careful, though, so even though biomass is theoretically it could be a carbon neutral energy production, in practice sometimes it's really not, because maybe there's fertilizer application involved in it, the transport required, or deforestation that might happen in order to grow the biomass. So the biomass needs to be done carefully for it to be a nicer alternative than fossil fuel. But, you know, even with these alternative solutions that we have, there can be kind of byproducts that happen after this piece. Yeah, thanks for that question. Yeah.
And I know the Norwegians are working on it, but is there anyone in the United States, at least academically, is working on carbon recapture for industrial purposes? They're actually capturing the smokestack, doing something to it, and then pumping it back into the ground where it can, where it can't hit the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's definitely way outside my expertise, so I don't know. I guess I would expect there probably are many research groups working on
there
it,
are.
But
yeah.
we're not personally involved in it.
But yes, there are capturing from the smokestacks, but also just extracting it from the atmosphere. You know, very early stages. Some of it looks like it could be successful. Not currently there, but you know, it takes energy to extract it, and is it a net? Currently, right now, it's hard to scale. I think you can do it at a small scale, but actually doing it at the scale of essentially, you know, the planet. That remains to be seen how feasible it's going to be, but it's certainly worth exploring. And you know, every 10 years, technology advances so much. 10 years from now, it might actually look feasible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an exciting idea for sure.
A lot of people planting trees.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, planting trees is another very low tech.
We have drones now that fly, and they'll shoot little pellets down. And inside the pellets are the seeds. The pellets are made of essentially like a compostable, degradable fertilizer. And they shoot them down from, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 feet in the air and just plant thousands of trees in a day. It's kind of amazing.
Wow.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, and so they can send, now they can program them and send out swarms. And so they'll send like 6 or 8 at once, or, you know, and probably in 10 years, it will truly be a swarm. But right now it's like 6, 8, 10. And they can do acres and acres and acres in a day.
And
very steep terrain, too, which humans have a difficult time accessing.
Brian, where are they doing that now, or where are they?
Oh, there's a number of companies that are providing service for planting trees, and they're doing it in the States, they're doing it in South America, and those are the two places I'm aware of. They're probably doing it in a lot of other places.
Okay.
I'm not.
Hmm. Yes.
So most of what we hear in terms of response to climate change is, okay, this is my plan to get to net carbon neutral by 2050, or, you know, pick a date. But, you know, this is really helpful, that seeing that CO2 is really, it's a big chunk of it, but it's not the entire story for climate change. And I imagine some of the things we would do to reduce CO2 emissions would probably have some, you know, similar effects, mm-hmm. to reduce other types of, you know, GWP, but it's depressing.
or
sobering.
Stick with absolutely. That. It's such a big problem. And you're right. So it's a little bit of a misnomer. Oftentimes people talk about their carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just carbon footprint. Really, they're covering all of these gases. So one of the things you might notice, has anyone done one of those online carbon footprint tools where you calculate your carbon footprint and it tells you what's the action that you could do that would most reduce your footprint? Anyone want to share what was some of the actions that they got? Yeah.
So I live in Cameroon, so I was really curious about that, because I think we're rich in Cameroon. We don't have an air conditioner, we have a used fridge. It's emitting all sorts of who knows what, or will eventually. But I mean, the big thing was airline travel.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And
airline
for
travel.
Work, I fly to Senegal, or I fly to the United States.
Yeah.
So that, I think for me, that was the huge thing.
Yeah, I think that's for a lot of people, that's a big one. Yeah. Anyone get anything else? Is there a big one that you remember? Another big one that a lot of students I've had, when I've done climate change classes, they get reduce your meat intake. That's another, often the top, meat or dairy. And that is, you know, it's related to the methane. So even though it's a carbon calculator, you know, they're incorporating other gases as well. Okay, great. So now we're going to just pivot so that we talk a little bit about how the climate change is expected to impact water resources. So I was thinking for this, I probably all of you have in the past done some, or learned about the water cycle, or talked about the hydrologic cycle. So I thought we could, if you'd like, on that piece of paper, you can kind of draw out what you remember of the water cycle. So think about, like, how is water moving around the globe? And then we'll kind of have a discussion of how that, how those different pathways that water can move is expected to be or is already being impacted by climate change. So one way that I often sort of think about drawing the hydrologic cycle or the water cycle is you can kind of draw a side view of a landscape. And then, so you got a bit of a mountain there, and it's draining down to a water body down here, so maybe that's a lake or a river. Maybe we have, you know, nice snow-capped mountain, got some trees and houses in our watershed. So this is kind of all part of a watershed. I better draw this as a house so we don't think it's just an arrow. And so think about how is water moving around in this landscape? That's the hydrologic cycle. And I'll just give you 2 minutes to kind of take out your paper and crayons and try to draw that. Yes.
Raise your hand if you need some materials.
Yeah, there's some paper and clipboards up here.
A little more paper.
Oh. And crayons.
Thank you. One of these.
Anybody else need paper?
I think they've got
you got enough colors over in your domains?
Why don't you give us a yellow?
There's kind of a yellow-orange there.
Just for the sun.
Yeah, there you go. You need a red?
Here, take a look.
I've got purple and yellow. That works. Say, elementary school.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, gotta draw the sun.
Okay, so that melts, it flows, and then it also evaporates, right?
Oh, did you want some
glasses,
Asia?
Oh, I have.
Pick your color. Fair question.
Wow.
So
now we got some. Yeah.
So, anyone want to share? What are some ways that water kind of moves around this system here that you came up with on your? John.
Precipitation,
awesome, yeah. Precipitation. So we can think of that as, you know, rain. So we can divide up precipitation into rain and then snow. Sleet and all kinds of other things, which we'll divide it that way for now. And what else?
Fog.
Evaporation.
Great, yeah, evaporation. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we're living in Humboldt County, a lot of the redwoods, well, the redwoods get approximately 30% of their water intake just from essentially condensation from the fog there. It's kind of amazing how much they're able to collect that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Melt and run off.
Yeah, melts. Yeah, so snow melts. And also just more generally runoff, which could be from snowmelt or could just be from rain.
aquifers.
And some of that goes into aquifers.
Yeah, absolutely great. So infiltration into our soils, into our groundwater aquifers. And then we have some groundwater flow too that will get to our rivers.
Sorption.
Sorption, yep, absolutely. And sorption is kind of another name for infiltration, so we can put that there. Into the soil.
Taking up one of the plants.
Yeah, so we're thinking about transpiration, right? So transpiration. So transpiration is when the plants take the water from the soil and evaporate it up. Well, basically they transport the water up through their leaves. So basically it serves the same purpose as evaporation when we're trying to think of our atmosphere in terms of water moving back up into the atmosphere.
They lose about 90% of the water they take up through transpiration. The rest of it's stored in the tissues, but most of it just goes right out the little stomata and the leaves, right out of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great.
Have you got irrigation?
Pumping. Irrigation, pumping, absolutely. Yeah, so that, let's see, how will we represent that? Irrigation, maybe it might come out of from the river or the... or might come out from our groundwater storage, so we'll draw the arrow that way. And pumping. Okay.
Fulton sprinklers.
Fulton sprinklers, right, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Having lived in Nebraska for a number of years, we saw the transfer from technology where they were just spraying irrigation to having hoses dropped down lower to the ground.
Great, yeah.
Evaporation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really important. Yeah, to prevent that. Because if you're irrigating, you really want to minimize evaporation and maximize transpiration. You can deliver a lot less water to your fields that way. Great, yeah.
So that house is drawing water to serve the house and wastewater.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So then we have our human water cycle too, where we've got water coming up in and then out. And there's so many different ways of doing that. I was thinking we might focus more on the sort of the more natural, which are also the larger fluxes from a watershed scale, and think about, we can kind of now talk through how these fluxes, we expect them to change with climate change. So what do you think about for evaporation? Or we could combine these into evapotranspiration. How might that change due to climate change?
More might be evaporated into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
As it's warmer.
Yeah, great.
And then the warmer air pulls more moisture, so your air is going to be
warmer. Exactly right. Yeah, so let's see. Maybe I'll use a different color for that. So evaporation, we expect it under a climate... in global warming, climate change, we expect it to increase. I'll draw a little green arrow there. And exactly right, there's more energy in the system now, and it takes energy to evaporate water. So that increases evaporation. The transpiration, that one's a really tricky one to predict. In some areas, we might get more transpiration. Certainly, we see increased plant growth with warmer temperatures, but at some point, plants will get stressed, and then they will do less transpiration, and it might grow less. So this is kind of like a mixed bag. We don't know if it's up or down, and it's probably very variable in different locations, in different types of crops or plants. And so this increase in evaporation is really important, and this kind of indicates then we have this intensification of the hydrologic cycle. So just as you mentioned, there's going to be more water vapor in the atmosphere, and it has the potential to carry more of that water. And therefore, precipitation is going to increase too overall.
So does that equal out?
Does it equal out? Yes. So in a way it equals out, right? So more is going up and then more is going down. That's true. But the issue is, you know, how that precipitation increases. So it is expected to increase in such a way that it's more intense rain, mm-hmm. or heavy rainfall. And so then we can then, from the precipitation, we can then move to some other processes like runoff. So when you have really intense rain, there's not enough time for this infiltration to happen, because it comes down too fast. So now the runoff also increases. And so what are some issues that we would face with increased runoff?
Flooding,
yeah, that's a really big one, increased flooding. And, oh, I forgot to mention in my slides, but that intro slide, that was a very recent devastating flooding in Germany that they've had, yes.
Also with wildfires, you get the runoff becomes terrible, mm-hmm. because there's no absorption.
Right. So after the wildfires, it changes the absorptive capacity of the soil, and so it and it can also transport all that sediment that's not held.
By decreased infiltration, correct?
If
the runoff is increased.
Yes. So how the
rapid runoff.
Right. Exactly. So it could be a double whammy, right? So the rain that then we get, it's sort of the that damaging rain, right? So it's so much that it's not rain that we can use. It's increasing runoff, increasing flooding chances, increasing also, remember, runoff is what picks up the pollutants on the surface of the earth, so that's where it can transport more pollutants, so we might have more water quality problems. And then, sadly, it also decreases our groundwater store, which is our more stable water source. Long-term water source, yeah.
And after yesterday, we're not sure that we want to add more dams.
Right, that's true. Yeah, and more dams increase evaporation, too.
What does it do to the ocean and acidification?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's sort of the other side to, so climate change, so it's not climate change itself that's causing the acidification of the ocean. It's the increased carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, because carbon dioxide, when it dissolves in water, it becomes carbonic acid. It's a weak acid. And so that's why the acidification of the ocean is related to the increase. It's actually directly related to carbon dioxide concentrations, and not so much necessarily just the whole process of climate change. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's a bit of a convoluted answer. Thanks.
No. I just trust your science.
Just one question. Now, you mentioned the dams. Was that related to hydroelectricity?
Or just
a plain dam?
My point that I was trying to make is that one of the ways that you mitigate against the runoff problem and flooding, mm-hmm. is you build dams. I live in a place where if there wasn't a dam upstream, I wouldn't be living in that place right now. Yeah. But we've learned because of the ecology of plants and fish and those kinds of things, they have been detrimental in many ways. Mm-hmm. So now we're caught in this thing of, if we have more intense rains, how are we going to, you know, help mitigate the result of those extra waters?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot, so basically a lot of the technology that's really effective for managing runoff is small scale. So I don't know if you've heard of green infrastructure being built in cities around you or residences around you. Basically areas where the soil has been amended to be extra accepting of infiltration. So high infiltration zones, so that kind of intercept with runoff pathways, or also kind of drain roads. So roads, you know, everything runs off of those. In normal ways, they'll just go straight into the rivers and cause floods, but they can kind of be infiltrated in bioswales or rain gardens and things like that. But there's small scale solutions that have to be all over the place to make a difference.
Places like China are trying some larger scale
solutions as well. They have desertification happening. So huge swaths of certain sections of China are essentially turning desert because of a lot of our impacts, essentially. And they're trying to reverse that through a number of different means. As Joe mentioned, soil amendments is something they're trying. So they're trying to add a lot more carbon to the soil. And if you have a higher carbon content in your soil, you typically can absorb and hold more water as opposed to just losing it quite immediately. And that, if you can get just 15% more water in that soil, that might just get the plants past that threshold. They're just basically trying to reestablish grasslands that used to be there. And it actually turns out a pretty big portion of the amount of water that comes into the sorts of biomes actually comes through condensation on the stems of the grass. So they, there's a lot of biofeedback where the organisms help to shape their own environment. And so by having the grass there, it helps it get more water into the soil. And the more grass there is, the more carbon there is. But they've, unfortunately, they've destroyed some of these ecosystems so bad that they really have to have a very tough time with it. They're building a lot of windbreaks, or they're trying to, planting a lot of trees just to try to keep these big rolling desert dunes from just literally absorbing whole towns as it just moves across. But there is research, and some of it is promising. So hopefully, we don't want to be too depressed.
What's the thinking about the individual practices, percent of the solutions, let's say there's some ideal solution, versus macro scale solutions? That's something that I haven't heard much about in the last 10 or 20 years.
You mean in terms of
addressing climate change, what percent of our individual behaviors affect what percent of the problem, and macro policy projects are going to address another percent. Is there any latest thinking on that?
I don't think that, I think individual actions are very important, but I think, to really address the, especially the emissions side of things, it has to be big policy. We have to be working together to create new systems. But that's not to discourage small scale individual actions. But it's like we also need to have system change. There's mitigating climate change, which is trying to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and make climate change less severe. And then there's also adapting to climate change. So right now we're kind of talking about how water systems are changing. And we just know that, we have to deal with more runoff and deal with less infiltration. So then we can come up with also adaptive solutions to, how do we react to this change in our hydrologic cycle so we still have clean water and we still have access. And I think, we definitely need both of those things happening. I definitely don't have a percentage number. I don't know.
I've never seen that quantified.
Yeah.
I think it's a difficult thing to actually put a number to.
But
they certainly would encourage both. Yeah. I guess the more buy-in you get from, just the common folks, the more likely you get more political action. Yes, we need macro scale solutions, but we also need, people just making their individual contributions as well. But it'd be interesting to see if we could try to actually break that down further.
You described the situation in China. Is that the same thing that's happening in the Sahara?
I'm not sure what you're saying.
Well, the desert is growing larger in Africa. Are they doing anything about it there?
Not that I'm aware of, in terms of research or macro scale solutions. I'm not aware of them attempting anything, but we hope that things, like what's being done in China, that typically will inform other regions, what worked and what didn't there. And it turns out that some of the research being done about the China issue is actually done in the States, because there's certain areas in the States that actually have very similar climate to the areas that are being affected by desertification. So a lot of the research isn't necessarily in China, it's actually being done all over the place. And so that research is being shared when it's successful and the technology is being shared. So it will likely spread. I think somebody had a comment about
that. So one of the things that's been attempted and that's been going on for about 15, 20 years is what they call a green belt. But I don't think it has sufficient support. So it's an attempt at just planting huge numbers of trees, and maybe like this approach using drones will be more successful way of doing that. And I know at least Senegal was having moderate success, but they're in the Sahel, so just south of the Sahara. But it's becoming continually more arid and people are moving. Mm-hmm. So if we go back to this morning's conversation about migration and immigration, we can go back to climate change as one of the causes. If we keep going deeper and deeper from the root causes, it's climate change. And it's the cause for some of the conflicts too. And I can give you specific examples.
Regarding Africa, Alan Savory has the Savory Institute in Africa, Africa, and they're doing reversing desertification, managing grazing of elephants. And so that's related to managing herds of animals as a tool to build carbon in the soil and improve resiliency of landscapes through managing the nutrient cycling that's happening there in a balanced way. And you could say all the pastoral traditional people still doing that in Africa today have always been doing that.
Yeah, and it's just been, I guess, seeing a pretty interesting documentary about sort of an intentional community in a way. I think it was in India, which you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but due to a lot of land use change, they basically cut down all the trees. And in this area, it basically turned into kind of a wasteland. They had all these photos, and it really was depressing looking with the moonscape. Incredible erosion problems, and no plants could establish. It just was really an awful situation. And through decades, this community, intentional community, they just had this initiative: we are going to plant trees. And so they just plant thousands and thousands of trees every year for decades. And it's been, I think, 50 years or something. I can't quite remember, but. Just the before and after, you know, and it's kind of, it's not macro, but it's actually a pretty big area. It's many thousands of acres that they've managed to reclaim. And speaking of how the creatures can shape their environment, now they actually have a lush pseudo rainforest. It's completely self-sustaining, and it's just remarkable how quickly the earth can heal itself. It might need a little help. This is also a very inspiring kind of story.
Well, I just want to be mindful of the time. I'm sorry, we went a little bit over, so I think we'll just have to end there. That's a really good point, I think, to end on, which is that, there are technological advances that we can look forward to for addressing climate change, but in fact, there are a lot of technologies already there, and so we really need societal developments and work. And so it's not just a job for the scientists or the engineers. It's really how can we cooperate and change our society and change policy. So, I hope you guys have got a few ideas, and we could continue talking about this topic a little bit tomorrow, maybe if we have time. A few other points to make. So thanks again for your time.